morning, everybody. So nice to see you all. Welcome to Reproductive Rights, Where Personal is Political. Looking forward to a very lively, engaged conversation with two women who have written some very important books recently that we're going to talk about a little bit today. So I'll start with an introduction of each of the panelists here, and going to let them talk about their books a little bit, and then I have a few questions for them, and then I'm hoping that we can have a conversation among all of us. So thanks for being here. My name is Joyce Linehan. Dr. Felicia Kornbluh is a professor at the University of Vermont and specializes in the histories of feminism, gender, social welfare, disability, law, Jews in the United States, and reproductive politics. They are professor of history and of gender, sexuality, and women's studies, and affiliated faculty in Jewish studies, and the author of, or co-author of, three books, including the one we're going to talk about today, A Woman's Life, is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. Hannah Matthews, immediately to my left here, is a writer, abortion doula, and community care worker based in Portland, Maine. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Elle, Esquire, Teen Vogue, Time, Glamour, McSweeney's, The Washington Post, and other publications. She publishes a free monthly abortion love letter, Bringing Down the Flowers, and works on another abortion love letters project in collaboration with Camila Ochoa Mendoza of the Abortion with Love podcast. Please welcome our two panelists. So as I said, two very important, but two very different books about the topic of abortion. And I'd like to start with you, Felicia, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
In the beginning of your book, you set up sort of an age-old tension in American activism, namely groups that should be natural allies who sometimes... Oh, actually, sorry. I wanted to start with you all talk. Sorry. I'm nervous. I don't do this very often. We're going to open by letting these two people talk about their books a little bit for about 5 to 7 minutes, and then we'll get into my question. Sorry, this is not about me. So, Felicia, would you please tell us a bit about your book?
Yeah, sure. And the sound is okay back there? Yeah? Okay, good. Good. Well, thanks, everyone, for being here. Really, really, really. And thank you for moderating. Thanks to the Boston Book Festival. I just want to start by acknowledging, first of all, the ongoing public health crises that are in reproductive health care today and ongoingly. And this was something that obviously was happening before the Dobbs decision came down from the Supreme Court, but even much more in the year plus since. We're coming up on the 51st anniversary of Roe versus Wade in January 2024. And we're in a state in terms of reproductive rights, health, and justice that that I don't think a lot of us could have anticipated even a couple of years ago. So my book is about two movements that overlapped and also diverged. And those are the movements that today we usually call the reproductive rights movement or reproductive rights cause and the reproductive justice movement or cause. And obviously they overlap enormously because they're both about granting people reproductive choice and options and dignity and self-control, self-sovereignty, right? In the face of governments that for generations, for hundreds of years, thousands of years, have sought to control people's reproductive options. And so they overlap in that way, but they also depart, and they depart in ways that are familiar, as Joyce was just starting to ask me about, but I'll preempt that a little bit. They diverge in ways that that are somewhat familiar in American politics, mostly around issues of race and class, although also age and issues of citizenship and language and so on. And so my book focuses on two people, two women, two people who identified themselves and were identified as women, my mom, the late Beatrice Kogan Kornbluh, and our next door neighbor, the late Dr. Helen Rodriguez Trias. And my mom, as I learned very, very poignantly and sadly only after she died, literally the morning after she died, my mom, she drafted the first bill in New York State, which was also the first bill in the United States, and probably the first in the world, that would have simply removed abortion from all state legal codes Right? No doctors in between people who are seeking abortion care and their access to care. No gatekeepers, no gestational ages, no viability standards, none of that stuff. The idea was that this was something that shouldn't be regulated by the state. And that essentially, when it was regulated by the state, which is something that happened in the US in the 19th century, that was an error, and it should be something that people should be able to figure out, you know, based on what was going on in their own lives, based on consultation with their partners, and yes, with their doctors or other medical providers, with clergy and so on, right? So this was a piece of legislation that was absolutely pioneering in the US and in the world. And it was introduced into the New York State Legislature in January of 1969 by two co-sponsors. One was a Republican woman from upstate New York. You won't see this today, right? She was the first one to do it. She was a vice president of the National Organization for Women in New York State. You won't see that today in today's Republican Party. And the co-sponsor, who was a legislator from my district, an Austrian Jewish refugee named Franz Leichter, whose mother, we found out later, had been the leading socialist feminist in interwar Vienna and was an official of the Vietnamese government under what was called Red Vienna, and was assassinated by the Nazis, both because she was Jewish and because she was a socialist. So Franz and this woman, assemblywoman Constance Cook, introduced the bill in January 69. It eventually passed, but in a watered-down form. And so what happened in New York was New York became the leader in the United States before Roe versus Wade and really set the stage for Roe with a bill that was less radical than my mom's bill, but still by far the most radical in the country, that gave people completely free access to abortion through the 24th week of a pregnancy and also had no residence requirement. So people came from all over the United States, even from all over the world, to access what were relatively affordable, and we can put an asterisk on that, safe and legal abortions before Roe. So this was like the quintessence of grassroots pressure. My mom was a feminist activist and a labor lawyer. She worked with the National Organization for Women. You know, there were more radical feminists than her who were also involved in this cause, and they're pushing from below. They got the state legislature to do something, and ultimately they got the Supreme Court to do something. That's how Roe v. Wade happened. And we can talk about what I think that says about, you know, what we can do today. And the other movement, which I'll just mention real briefly, that my late next door neighbor was the center woman of, was a movement to fight sterilization abuse. And that was also a reproductive rights movement, we could say, or in today's terms, a reproductive justice movement, which was sensitive to the ways that US empire in Puerto Rico and controls on people's access to reproductive health care, and racial and class subordination all set the stage for people to be subject to sterilization abuse. The situation was that by the end of the 60s, on the island of Puerto Rico, they had the highest rates of sterilization in the world. 35% of women of reproductive age had been sterilized. And this was something that finally came to the attention of feminists on the US mainland only in the middle 1970s, after Roe versus Wade, right? So after Roe, there were left feminists, some of them white, most of them non-white, and a lot of them from working class backgrounds, who said Roe is, you know, what do we say today? It's the floor, it's not the ceiling, right? So Roe is a starting point for them, and they said, look, we need to go beyond if we really care about people's reproductive rights, and we need to also ensure that people are not subject to sterilization abuse or any coercion in their reproductive healthcare decisions, right? So they formed an organization called the Committee to End Sterilization Abuse, or CESA, the first organization in our history that fought sterilization abuse, and then in the later 70s, a bigger group called CARASA, the Committee for Abortion Rights and Against Sterilization Abuse. And that, for me, is the foundation point of the modern movement for reproductive justice, right? A movement that's economically sensitive, that's sensitive to questions of language and empire, and sensitive to the ways that racial injustice also imposes all kinds of coercion and restriction on people's reproductive choices. So that's what my book is about.
Thanks. It's about a lot more, too.
Thank you so much. Hard to follow. I wrote this book for many reasons, but I think the main reason I wrote this book is to help folks understand that there is no such thing as an abortion expert, and the only expert on any given abortion is the person having it, period. And I had many crises of faith in my ability to write it, in the necessity of it, right? I'm a cis white woman whose abortion stories get told, cis white women who get publishing contracts, cis white women. And in my community, I did have some folks who were like, you know what? This is really not interesting to me because you're a cis white woman working in a high access state. And it was easy for you to get care. It was easy for you to get the funding you needed when you needed funding. And I think that's totally reasonable and fair. And I also think that in writing it and in writing my own abortion story and so many other stories, and also in my work, which since 2017, I have seen abortions that range from someone taking their pills and then going to class and then going to a football game and then going to a party and truly having like no interruption of their daily life, to now my work in an all trimester clinic where I help people have abortions that involve laboring, delivering fetuses, having funerals for those fetuses. So it really, the more meaningful time we can spend with people having their abortions as they have them, I think the more we can come to understand that we don't know anything about abortion and that actually the word abortion has been so effectively in our minds and in our politics come to mean something when, you know, not to collapse the meaning of words, but doula, abortion, like these words can mean anything. And so this is not to say there aren't people you should absolutely look to and learn from. You should read Loretta Ross, you should read Dorothy Roberts, right? You should read Viva Ruiz. But I wrote this book as a love letter to my own abortion and to just anyone who reads it, to kind of say, you know, this is an invitation to come share this space with me of the abortions that I'm helping to create, and the joy I'm helping to protect for other people. But this is not me teaching you or lecturing you in any way. So it was very difficult to write. I am really glad it's in the world because I have, now that it's in the world, it is part of a conversation, right? It's not just like an object that belongs to me that I created. It's something that people are engaging with, and criticizing and, you know, telling me about, and seeing human beings in relationship with the book is just like beyond my wildest dreams. So that's all I really wanted. And I also wrote it, I don't know about you all, but I recently, there was an essay that I think was called I'm Accidentally on Strike. And I, since 2020, but probably before then, a lot has happened, right? And I've had a child, and that's absolutely part of it. But I cannot read more than a tweet. Like, I am struggling. I am struggling. It takes me an hour to compose an email. I am just dragging myself through the day, bribing myself with chocolate chips for doing very simple tasks. So I wrote this book in very digestible little chunks, and I wrote it so that you could pick it up. You know, you look at the titles, abortion is sex, abortion is justice, abortion is indigenous, abortion is parenthood, abortion is nature, and abortion is a holy blessing. And you can go to the section that you feel called to or that you want to read at that moment. And if there's a section you don't feel interested in, you absolutely do not have to engage with it. And I wrote it hopefully to be for people like me who are like on the subway with a book open, but really their phone is inside the book and they're like looking at Instagram and they're like, oh my God, why am I looking at Instagram? I'm supposed to be reading. I need to read a book. Or if you are like me and you say you're gonna read, so you like drag a book with you like in your bag everywhere, or like from room to room, and then you absolutely do not even open it, you just look at your phone. You know, these, you're my people if that's something that is a struggle for you. And so that is kind of another, you know, again, there is such a deep well of theory and philosophy around abortion care and abortion access and reproductive justice, and it's all so incredible. And that's not my ministry. I always say my place in the revolution is just like holding someone's hand or holding their hair back while they throw up, or, you know, next to their exam bed, or drawing their blood, or, you know, giving them a ride, giving them $20. So another enormous factor in my desire to write this book is for everyone else to understand that they also have a place in the revolution, and it might not look like what you would assume. I think folks often think, because I know I thought before I got into clinical work, I'm not a doctor, I'm not an attorney, I'm not, you know, I have nothing to offer when it comes to helping people have the abortions they want, but that is not true, and there are so many places for you in the fight. So I wrote it so that maybe, hopefully, it could open a door to like a little new place that feels joyful and pleasurable for you.
Can I just add one thing on that? Because I think that's such a wonderful, important message. And, you know, I'm trying to hold these two things in my story. Like, there are these two women who are at the center of the story who I think were really extraordinary. I mean, and my mom was one of them, so yay. and I think Rodriguez Trias even more so. So I'm trying to hold that, like the honor of the people who have been out front doing just such amazing work. And most of those people, we don't even know their stories.
Right.
And at the same time to say like, they needed troops, you know, and we all, you know, and this movement needs every single one of us. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. So you can see two really different books, two very personal books, but two very different books. So I apologize in advance for the whiplash that we're about to experience. but let's stick with that a little bit, Hannah. So the book is obviously for people who've had an abortion or are having an abortion or know someone who's had an abortion, but it also feels very much like it's for the rest of the community.
Yeah.
And sort of gently suggesting to them the ways in which they can help support, you know, create a community of support. And you seem to be saying that everyone potentially has a role here. Everybody can be part of the intricate, what you call the intricate map of abortion support work.
Yeah.
For those of us here who want to help but aren't sure how, can you talk about the importance of that community and the ways that you see it manifest?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am not based in Boston, so I know there are folks here who are much more qualified to speak on like Boston's local movement and, you know, places you can get involved in this city. But in my city alone, there is a volunteer drivers network of folks who just give someone a ride to a clinic because there's very little public transportation in my state. There is an abortion fund that, no questions asked, provides, you know, the full fee and money for food and gas and all of that for someone who can't afford their abortion, and there's no qualifications on that. So there are folks who help us do that. There are people who work as clinic escorts. My wonderful agent is one of them. She's been working as a clinic escort outside of a clinic in New York, which I really love. And that is like a very entry level, like if you are comfortable kind of being with people and not engaging with other people. And if you are someone who is safe and feels safe to do so, that can be like a really incredible, really low barrier kind of, because you don't, there's not much movement. There's not much, you know, it's not like you need to be like engaging in any kind of combat or debate. And in fact, you shouldn't be. But it's just kind of being with someone in that moment as they're walking from, you know, the train to their appointment, or helping hold open a door for someone. And then really, I mean, at this moment, I would say the two things I tell everyone who asks me, give money if you can on a monthly basis, even if it's $5 a month, to an abortion fund, because abortion funds are running dry as we kind of scramble to, you know, meet the need that's growing and growing and growing, and folks are having to travel more for their appointments. Their appointments are being pushed back further in their pregnancies. Mm-hmm. They're needing, enormous sums of money, and often these people are young, or their parents, or they're working three jobs, or you know they didn't have money in the first place for the $25 copay. So give, if you can, monthly to an abortion fund. And then the other thing I always tell folks is just talk about abortion. Just say, if you are safe to do so, if you feel safe to do so, incorporate it into your social, emotional life the way you talk about birth and death and illness. And, you know, I write about the day I had my medication abortion. My partner went to work and said, like, oh, I have to leave early. Hannah's not feeling well because she's having an abortion. And everyone at his workplace who I think did a good job of kind of like pretending they weren't shocked by this. You know, it like, I for so many reasons, right? Abortion implies sex. It implies a certain politic. Like, it kind of brings into the room all these things that, you know, you might be kind of, you might not feel safe discussing. But if you are safe to do so, just bring abortion into the conversation the way you would any other bodily process, any other, you know, mental health or emotional experience you're having. Like, it just is so, so important. Because everywhere around you at all times are many people who've had abortions or who are going to have abortions. And so there's no reason we should pretend that's not the case.
Right, and you even make a point, use the word abortion. Right?
Use the word abortion.
That's important.
Yeah.
So Felicia, I'm gonna go back to the question that I asked too early. But so you talk about the that it's an age-old tension in American activism, right? Groups that should be natural allies who sometimes find themselves working either on different tracks at best or at odds at worst. You talk about this a lot in your book with the work of your mother and the doctor. But we're at this very important inflection point right now in the abortion conversation. What lessons do we take from the work that your mother and the doctor did back in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, and just to say her name was Helen Rodriguez Trias. And she was a Puerto Rican doctor who divided her time. Her life was both on the island of Puerto Rico in San Juan and in New York City. And she made important contributions in both places. The first thing that I think we need to learn from their stories is that activism works. Grassroots action works. It absolutely works. There's no question about that. It worked then. It'll work today. You know, it has worked, of course, since the Dobbs opinion came down, and we've seen these incredible campaigns all over the country, right? It works, it works, it works. Everything we do, everything we put into every shoulder, you know, put to the wheel, makes a difference. In New York, just on the abortion side of things, in 1967, they thought they were going to need a constitutional amendment, either at the state level or even at the federal level, in order to decriminalize abortion. They won in 3 years, right, with the most ambitious statutory, that is legislative, decriminalization of abortion in U.S. history. They won in 3 years. Right, imagine what we can do today with the kind of numbers we have. So that's number one. And on the anti-sterilization side, they won incredible victories that have not been overturned, right? Like, we still have the victories that they won at the New York City level, and then at the federal level, not through the courts, but through what was then called the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, now HHS, right? So, A, it works. B, there are tensions, and I think what I take away from this is that on the one hand, there are short-term battles that we have to fight, right? There are people who need abortion access right now who aren't getting it, and we have to do all of those things. We have to pay money, we have to drive, we have to engage in public policy work, we have to knock on doors, we have to, you know, speak out, persuade our friends, et cetera, in order to ensure that people have abortion access. And that is, right, it's a matter of gender justice, it's a matter of racial and economic justice, right? We know this. You know, what's the number one reason people say they need abortions, they need access to abortions? It's because they can't afford to have kids, right? We live in a fucked up society, pardon my language, you know, that does not ensure people economic justice. And sometimes people, you know, feel the need to make that choice. And then there's lots of other reasons too, right? So we need to be in that fight. And at the same time, we need to keep our eye on the ball of our long-term goal, which is reproductive justice for all people. Right? Absolutely. And we need to have the ability to continue to dream and continue to critique the existing movement, and continue to listen and continue to understand that there are people who have different experiences from ours, you know? And work just as hard for the long-term future, the world we really want to create, as we do to deal with these short-term crises. I've spent a lot of time on the boards of both the regional and the state level Planned Parenthoods in my area. I live in Vermont. And even before Dobbs, it was very hard, you know, because you always feel like your hair's on fire. Like, abortion, 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 oh my God, what are they doing? And it's so bad. And also we know that, you know, we have democracy on our side, if democracy can only be exercised. And at the same time, you know, the fight that we were having in Planned Parenthood, still are having in the legacy repro organizations, is to continue to fight for a better world, a world in which people can choose to have children as well as to refrain from childbearing. We have to be able to do both.
Yeah, you're right. And I think something I have been, you know, I'm sure we all have been kind of struggling to engage with the news around what's happening in Palestine and Israel. And I just keep thinking, I mean, it is so, like, I am bringing into every room with me and like every minute the knowledge that, you know, there are 37,000 pregnant Palestinians right now with no electricity, no water, no access to medical care, who are going to have to give birth in these conditions. And that is so connected to the pregnant people I'm helping here, whether they're, you know, no matter the outcome of their pregnancy. It's just, it's all connected, like you said, and it's all that short-term crisis is, you know, this tiny piece of this, like, long, long, long struggle that was happening, you know, before the Catholic Church, before the U.S. government. Like, people have been having abortions since people have existed, and will have abortions as long as we exist. But also, we will need to fight as long as we exist to ensure that poor folks are able to parent when and how and if they want to. You know, trans people have access to adequate prenatal care, reproductive care, information, all of these things, you know, that people who are undocumented living in the United States are able to get to either prenatal appointments or abortion appointments without crossing, you know, border checkpoints. Like, the barriers that have been deliberately put in place are so violent and can feel so overwhelming, especially when we're talking about these large, you know, these horrifyingly large numbers of pregnant Israelis, pregnant Palestinians, who are suffering and who have died. And just, I think, I tell this story in the book, it's like this really cheesy, the doula who said it to me was like, oh, I probably saw this on like someone's aunt's Facebook page, like it's so cheesy, but it is for me very helpful of the allegory of the person walking onto the beach and seeing all these starfish that have washed up and that are dying in the sun, and just one by one starting to, you know, pick up the starfish and throw them back into the ocean, and the person who's with them just being like a hater and being like, well, it doesn't matter, look at all, like, you can never save all these starfish, and the person just picking one up and saying, well, it wasn't pointless for that one, it wasn't pointless for that one, it wasn't, you know. So every person you help have their abortion, or every person you help like build their own life in which they are giving birth and parenting when they want to and in the way they want to, is, you know, that's everything to that person. And that's everything to their potential children and to the people around them who, you know, we know that access to safe and affirming abortion care leads to better educational outcomes, better financial outcomes, better economic outcomes for their community, right, that the person is moving through. So it really, like, the ripple effects of one abortion that is obtained, you know, joyfully or in the way that is safe for that person and is best for that person, like, really can't be underestimated.
I was going to ask you about starfish.
But the starfish.
Sorry, Felicia.
No, that's okay. I mean, I know this isn't a panel about what's going on in the Middle East, but I just want to also name the Israeli victims of Hamas violence from last weekend, and make sure that we're, you know, we're naming all the victims. Yeah, yeah. I just wanted to make sure we were doing that.
Thank you. Felicia, the big question from your book seems to be, what if from the beginning these different groups of people had worked together, and what if it had been about the right to bear and raise children, right? Can you talk about that a little bit, like what a holistic movement might have looked like, so that we might learn some lessons?
Yeah. So the most difficult part of the story is that it wasn't just that that some of the people that my mother was doing activism with weren't engaged in the anti-sterilization fight, but actually they were opposed, right? So what happened when Dr. Rodriguez-Trias and others in CESA and CARASA started to bring forward these regulations on sterilization abuse was that their most important opponents were the National Organization for Women at the national level and Planned Parenthood. Those were the most powerful opponents. And you couldn't have a better example of a kind of intersectional failure, right? Or the need for an intersectional analysis. Like the people who were making policy at NOW and Planned Parenthood really couldn't see the sterilization abuse problem. And from their perspective, you know, anything that they understood as a control on people's access to a form of reproductive health care, and they saw sterilization as a form of reproductive health care, right? That in itself was a denial of people's rights and was sort of a slippery slope leading to denials of access to abortion care. So that, you know, it's painful and difficult to see those divisions. And I can't help thinking that the failure of the women's movement and the repro movement at that point and ongoing failures to understand the stakes in the struggle to allow people to have access to all forms of reproductive health care and to choose childbearing as well as to choose refraining from childbearing, that's been incredibly determinative. Like, so what happens after the late 70s into the 80s and 90s? These issues get totally mapped onto our two political parties, and the Republicans become the antis and the Democrats become like the people who are in favor of abortion access, but not necessarily in favor of the whole menu of reproductive options, right? So the Republicans say, you know, the Democrats are the party of death and we're the party of life. And if the liberals, the Democrats, the women's movement, the repro movement had really stood for and had really embraced people's ability, people's dignity, people's freedom to choose, you know, all of the possible options, then I don't think that our mainstream politics would have gotten ugly in quite the same way that they got ugly. And I don't think that conservative Republicans and extreme conservative Catholics and evangelical Protestants would have been able to get away with characterizing the women's movement and the repro movement, you know, in the way that they have. I think that things might have turned out really, really differently. And also, like, just think about, like, in the late 70s, people were already talking about how police violence, for example, urban police violence, is a denial of reproductive freedom, right? What if we had had consistent politics and abolitionist politics, right, from the late 70s to the present, that said, yes, you know, we're in favor of a reproductive freedom or a reproductive justice agenda. And that means, God damn it, you know, we need to invest in public housing. And we need to invest in making sure that, you know, anybody who has kids can afford to feed those kids, you know, and has a safe neighborhood, and that they're not going to get gunned down by the police. Like, what if we had really embraced that politics? I think it would have shattered the cynical effort, right, of anti-feminist conservatives and Republicans to use these issues to drive a wedge between so many people who, you know, want to be on the side of families and kids and parents. but who may feel a little put off by, you know, an abortion-only politics, right? I think just think it would have scrambled those politics and would have made it much, much harder for people to accuse feminists and repros and Democrats and liberals of opposing family life. And I just want to say that there's always been this strain in the movement, which we have to embrace and remember, that has been, you know, what I would call a pro-life agenda, you know, and pro-family life, pro-options, pro-dignity. Yeah.
So we need to learn from that and think about language. Language is really important.
Exactly.
The great thing about both of these books is that there are lots of personal stories about real people in them. And you know, Hannah's talked quite a bit about them. Felicia, I just wanted to, would you quickly recount the story of George Michaels, which was really, really touching to me?
Yeah, sure. One thing that's really interesting about the story is that in New York, they did win, right? They won this amazing historic victory in 1970. They won it by one vote. And the one vote was this guy who decided to change his vote. He was an upstate New York Democrat. And he knew that he was going to be primaried and probably lose his seat if he voted in favor of abortion access. He was a Jewish guy. And he had a son who was a Reform Jewish rabbi, and a daughter-in-law who was a feminist. And he had them over for Passover, for the Jewish holiday of Passover, and his daughter-in-law started lobbying him. And when it came time for the vote, initially he indicated that he was going to vote against this version of my mom's bill. And then he stood up on the floor shaking and crying and said, "Speaker, I have to change my vote." And what he told reporters was that he felt like he couldn't go home if he didn't change his vote. He couldn't ever talk to his daughter-in-law again if he didn't change his vote. And he couldn't live with himself. So he changed his vote. He did get primaried by an anti-abortion Democrat. He did lose his seat. He never served in public office again, but he was always proud of the vote.
One vote, everyday heroes in all different shapes and sizes. We'd love to take some questions from the audience. Great. I think a microphone is going to be passed around. We got one down here. Actually, while we're getting that set up, can you just talk briefly about the word doula, which you
sure? Yeah. So this is also like doula is not a word that everyone in the movement agrees on or likes. It has some association for some folks to slavery because its Greek origins do mean like female slave or helper to, you know, someone who is either bearing children or, you know, having some kind of bodily experience that other women were expected to be around to help with. So not everyone likes it. I like it because it's a shorthand that kind of I find in most cultural contexts people kind of understand, even if they just think about it in terms of childbearing and labor and delivery. But for me, a doula is whatever that person needs. So like sometimes it's like, I'll take your crying phone call at 2 a.m. Sometimes it's like, I'll help you get on a flight and we'll like fly together to D.C. and get your 3-day long procedure done and like, you know, stay with you and pray with you and all these things. And sometimes, yeah, it literally means like leaving a casserole on someone's doorstep or cookies that I bought and didn't make.
So everyone can be a doula if you want to. We had a question over here.
Yeah. Inspired by the example of my rabbi, who every year has a service about reproductive freedom, reproductive justice. She has shared very publicly the story of her own abortion, and some people I was sitting with shared as well. I had known them forever and had no idea. So I was wondering if you could comment on the role and responsibility of leaders of faith and spiritual communities.
Yeah. Can I start on that one?
Right.
Yeah. So every year, the National Council of Jewish Women coordinates around the country Repro Shabbat. And there are many liberal Protestant denominations that have also gotten in the action. So liberal Jewish communities, mostly conservative, Reconstructionist, and Reform congregations do this on a Friday night and a Saturday. It's when we read this particular portion of the Book of Exodus, which is where Jewish Jewish law on abortion comes from. I've participated in that a lot in my own synagogue. I've spoken publicly and also at my home synagogue in New York City. So that's something that people might want to look out for. And if you are a member of a synagogue or a church, encourage them to get involved in a repro Shabbat and to take time to focus on these issues. And there's a big section of my book which is about the role of clergy and the role of communities of faith in the decriminalization of abortion. And there was this group in New York. Have people heard of Jane, the abortion service in Chicago? There were like two movies about it, right? So Jane was fantastic, right? It's something that comes out of the women's liberation movement. There was a group in New York called the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion, which actually helped people find many, many, many more abortions than Jane did. It was a national network of clergy, mostly Protestant and Jewish clergy, who helped people at a time when abortion was illegal and when even assisting somebody was illegal, to find safe, although illegal, abortions. And to me, that's just it's an example of the kind of risk-taking that people were willing to do in the late 60s and 70s. And for me, the punchline is like, what are we willing to do? Whether we consider ourselves people of faith or not, right? These are people who are willing to go to jail. Doctors, clergy, right? Members of faith communities. They were willing to house abortion clinics in their churches and their synagogues. Are we willing to do that? Are we willing to break the law? And if not, you know, why not?
Yeah, and I will add, I actually, in my book, there's a chapter called Abortion is a Holy Blessing, in which I interview many leaders of faith, but Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, who is one of the founders of Rabbis for Repro, I spoke with that rabbi for a long time, and we, everything she has to say is just incredibly beautiful. But there are now, there's Faith Allowed, which is a free confidential hotline that is only members of the clergy for people to call if they are in spiritual crisis about their abortion or want spiritual guidance or just want, you know, comfort. I've had many, you know, I think the number of practicing Catholics and people who identify as Catholics who have abortions, it's like a quarter of all U.S. abortion patients. And so these are people, right, who have often internalized some pretty hateful messaging for their whole lives about what they are doing in this moment. And often they really need a lot of kind of spiritual comfort. There are definitely networks of chaplains who work in clinics and hospitals mm-hmm. with patients having abortions, which is really beautiful. And there's a lot of spiritual text and official liturgy in pretty much every world religion that supports our right to have abortions, which I think is often for folks an entry point they really need, is like, well, the Bible tells me this, so that's, or the Torah tells us that this is what God, you know, has kind of signed off on and is saying that we're okay and still beloved and still made in God's image and, you know, whatever the language is that they need. So there are definitely, and of the people, I will say to your point, of the people breaking the law right now across the country and of the people really risking deportation, risking, you know, incarceration, many, many, many of them are people of faith and people from anti-abortion faith communities mm-hmm. working within those communities. And it is so beautiful and just like the most heroic things are being done. Even now with the level of police surveillance we have, which is like so much more insidious than, you know, what folks had to deal with in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and even 5 years ago. You know, there's like face recognition software, like clocking where we're going, things like this. And still people are just really putting their own life on the line in pursuit of, you know, their communities thriving and surviving. And abortion is a huge part of that for sure.
Yeah.
Other questions? Oh, we have a lot of them. Down the back there, in the center.
Hi. This is my first time talking to a microphone.
Congratulations.
So I wanted to ask a question that, just a concern that was raised for me while you're talking. I'm sorry, I can't remember either of your names.
Hannah.
Felicia.
Okay, Felicia.
Yes.
About people breaking the law in order to get other people access to abortion. And my concern with that is I admire the people who do that and put their lives on the line and put their future on the line to help others. But what I was wondering if you could comment, what does that mean for the movement if people are getting abortions illegally? Does that give people who oppose abortion ammunition in the future? And is there a difficult question between helping one person in the moment when that could damage the whole future of the movement?
Mm. Yeah, thanks for the question. I think there's room for a million different kinds of activism and a million different kinds of participation in this movement. Personally, I don't worry about the reputation of the movement. I mean, people who are against abortion, they think that we're all going to hell. Our reputation isn't so good with them, right? No matter what. There's nothing we can do to preserve our reputation. And I think, personally, I wear it as a badge of honor. You know, if anybody asks me, I can say, actually, my religion tells me that that the worst thing is to constrain somebody's options. You know, the worst thing is to, you know, to diminish the human life of the person who has to make decisions about their own pregnancy, right? That is a sin, where I come from. And so I'm willing to have that fight or that, you know, that argument. And illegality per se, I don't think is the key threshold. I also think that no movement can ask everybody to break the law. You know, some people can't go to jail. You know, they've got responsibilities that make that impossible. So I would never ask everybody to do that. I would ask everybody to think about what we can do, what each of us can do. You know, and I would ask us to remember that there was a time when there were doctors who said, you know, my commitment to the principle of do no harm means that I must provide this procedure, even if the law of my state tells me that I'm not allowed to do it. And there were clergy people who said, my commitment to a moral law, you know, is more important than this human-made law, which I think is wrong, right? I think it's important for us to know that and to have those examples and to have examples today of people taking that action, and we all have to figure that out for ourselves. No, you know, no judgment, no, you know, no raising of the bar beyond what's really possible for people to do.
I would also say there are lawyers working,
yes, that too,
around the clock 24 hours a day. Like, there are lawyers filing emergency injunctions, like trying to stop these waves of legislation, but also helping individuals. So there's the Repro Legal Defense Fund. A hotline you can call for legal advice, free legal advice. And then, yeah, in any kind of abortion, like doula training you would do or advocacy training you would do, there are, if it's a good one, it will teach you the ways to keep people safe who are coming to you. So, like, don't, you know, please do not send me an Instagram DM saying, like, I need an abortion, it's illegal in my state, here's my plan. Like, please do not do that. There are encrypted platforms, there's Signal, there's Proton Mail. When you can, I always say meet in person and privately. You know, things like that that are kind of safeguards, and then how we're using our devices. Can you make your abortion appointment on someone else's phone that's not going back to your house with you? Like, things like this. And there's also the Digital Defense Fund, which is mm-hmm. on the front lines of this. So it's really like, if you are going to break the law, here is what we would tell someone who was going to break the law so that they could stay safe and keep their family safe. And then if you're not safe to break the law, and if you need to if you need to respect the laws of your specific, you know, state or country where you are, here is how you could still potentially get the care you need while not technically breaking the law or while not doing something that could be, you know, pointed to as aiding and abetting. So I just want to shout out those resources because it is like, I think this is also a big fracture in the movement is mm-hmm. like often, especially folks who don't work in clinical spaces say like, well, these doctors who are doing this are cowards if they're refusing to. And, you know, it's often like, look, this doctor has 3 children at home. Like, and if she goes to prison, guess what? We have no doctor in that state anymore. So it's a really, it's really difficult. And there's a lot of moral injury that's happening all the time, especially I think for clinic workers and providers who are having to kind of live their lives by laws that make absolutely no sense.
We have time for one more quick question, also down the back there on the end.
Hi, everyone. My name is Marielle. Hannah and Felicia, thank you so much for the work you're presenting. I have been talking about abortion since 6th grade. My aunt has been really clear about like how important her abortion was to the life that she's led. But I'm currently a single mom of 3-year-old twins, and I donate pretty regularly to Moms Demand Action and Parenthood. I also try and talk to my representatives about reparations and childcare subsidies. And I end up feeling a lot of outrage. Like, why is this all falling on me? And I feel like it is actually like impacting my ability to be an activist for the movement. And so, so the question.
We're with you so far, outrage, yeah?
But the question is like, I have so much outrage. Felicia, the bill your mom and your neighbor's work is so incredible and extraordinary, and it's not radical. It's not radical to want bodily autonomy, and I just feel so frustrated, like, why is it falling? Like, the system is purposefully doing this so that I don't feel like I have any bandwidth. So how can we invite, like, abortion has never been illegal for men who have money and privilege, right? Like, how do we invite Republicans back to the table? How do we mm-hmm. invite men to be allies? How do we work around outrage? Oh my gosh, we could take a year talking about this.
Thank you so much. You have 3-year-old twins.
You want to start?
The fact that you just stood up and finished a single sentence to me, hero,
right.
American hero.
Yeah. My mom actually had twin babies when she was writing this bill. My sister was 3 when my sister Rebecca and I were born. So we were 2.5 years old. So I don't know how that worked. Maybe she just wrote the bill like in a fog, you know, in a parental fog in the middle of the night. I guess the only big thing I have to say about that is like a patriarchy is fucking strong. It's really strong. You know, like one of the things that I get just from in my own activism, but also from reading this book is like, it just takes a ton to get the rock up the hill. Like they're fighting all the time. It's always there. Patriarchy and capitalism and white supremacy, they're really strong and they're up there fighting all the time. And so I don't know, it gives me a little bit of comfort just to think that, okay, my exhaustion and my outrage, like it's appropriate, you know? It is actually appropriate and necessary. And there isn't ever going to be a time when we're not in that fight. And that, you know, that whole sort of narrative about how, oh, after Roe versus Wade, we felt like everything was going to be fine. And then after Dobbs, we woke up and we're like, oh my God, it's not fine. Like I don't, there was never a moment when it was really fine, you know? Not in 1973 and not in 1977 when the Hyde Amendment was passed and not in 1980 when the Supreme Court said the Hyde Amendment was fine and, you know, not through those many, many, many other moments. There was never a moment when it was fine. There was never a moment when there wasn't economic coercion and racial oppression that was impinging on people's reproductive autonomy. So I think we need to learn for ourselves how to fight smart, how to fight together, and how to love ourselves and each other, and how to, you know, how to care for ourselves and each other. I think as a practicing Jew, I've only really been like going regularly to services for the last 5 years or so, but I've learned about Sabbath. Like, we should all have a Sabbath every week. You know, take 24 hours off. Patriarchy and capitalism and white supremacy will still be there when we're done.
So I don't want to end on white supremacy, but that does seem like a good place to stop. I want to thank both of you for your really important work. Thank you for giving us the words, the tools, the ammunition. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Felicia.
Thank you. Felicia and Hannah are going downstairs to the signing area.